At 6:23, this is KERA News. I'm Justin Martin. The state of Texas has been ordered to pay more than $600,000 in fees related to its unsuccessful fight to defend its ban on same-sex marriage. The Texas Tribune reports the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals made the ruling yesterday. The fees stem from a lawsuit filed years ago by two couples, one of them in North Texas, Mark Ferris, and his husband, Victor Holmes. They challenged the constitutionality of the state ban. The U.S. Supreme Court legalized same-sex marriage in 2015. It's now up to a bankruptcy court in Delaware to decide what becomes of Oncor. The judge in the case wants to sell the Dallas-based electric delivery company to pay off creditors of its parent company, Energy Future Holdings. The Public Utility Commission last week rejected an $18 billion offer from NextEra Energy. But Dallas Morning News reporter Jeff Mosier tells KERA's Sam Baker the part of the story isn't over.
Well, NextEra said at their bankruptcy hearing that they are still going to take a shot at this, but they didn't give any descriptions of what they think they could do to revive the deal. The PUC and NextEra seemed very far apart and seemed like NextEra's deal killers linked up with the PUC's deal killers.
What were these deal killers?
Independence. The PUC believes that Oncor needs an independent board, or at least a majority of the board, that cannot be replaced or appointed by NextEra. NextEra, if they're going to spend $18 billion, they want to have some semblance of control over that company, and they want to have a say in it.
This isn't the first deal to fall apart. There was last year's offer from the Ray Hunt family in Dallas. Is the Hunt family through with Oncor, or is it possible they could come back?
They haven't been commenting, but the general perception among people involved in the bankruptcy hearings and involved in this whole process think that the Hunts could, if they get their investors back and can raise the money, would come back and have a shot at this.
What are the possibilities for what could happen to Oncor if either one of those don't come to fruition?
That other option would be for equitization, basically taking Oncor and saying, all right, all you creditors, you now own a piece of it, and we're going to sell a piece of Oncor to the public, so it'll be kind of a publicly owned company. A lot of the bondholders don't necessarily want to do that because they want to get their cash out of it. They don't want to own part of another company. They just want their money. And I've also been told that there could be tax issues with that. An argument for a third auction is that people have seen two auctions go south. They have a pretty good blueprint of what the PUC thinks and what they want. So it wouldn't be hard for a company, as long as they had the finances to do it, to come in here and say, we know what we can do to make this deal happen.
So the question is whether there's a company willing to meet the PUC's terms.
Exactly. We do know that Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett's company, was interested in the past and poked around, looked at the financials, so they could be involved. The Hunt family could come back with this. There were apparently multiple companies that had some interest. Whatever happens, this thing will probably take at least another year.
What have these two failed attempts to buy Oncor, has it had any effect on Oncor itself?
By all accounts, no. Normally, it's not desirable to be in a company that has an unsettled future. But throughout their parent company's financial turmoil and bankruptcy, Oncor has been able to do their job efficiently. They've been able to raise money to pay for infrastructure projects. The reason why Texas is leading the nation in wind power is in part because Oncor was one of the group of Texas power companies that the state asked to participate in a project to link up West Texas and the Panhandle with the rest of the state with power lines. They did all of this at the time that their parent company was struggling and seemed to be heading towards bankruptcy. So they've been operating pretty efficiently this whole time, and I think the PUC doesn't see that changing even if they keep rejecting deals. The PUC's concern is more about agreeing to the wrong deal rather than having Oncor still stay unsettled and not have a clear picture of what their future is.
Jeff Mosier, thank you for being with me.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Jeff Mosier is an energy and environment reporter for the Dallas Morning News. National Geographic photographer Joel Sartori is on a mission to photograph every single species living in zoos, aquariums, and wildlife sanctuaries around the world. Several of the photos will be on display at the Dallas Zoo starting tomorrow. Joel Sartori joins me now to talk about the photo arc and his goal to catalog portraits of 12,000 animals. Joel Sartori, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
First, why do this? Why take photographs of animals that are already in zoos?
Well, because it's really hard to convince a tiger in the wild to come out and lay on my big black background with my studio lights around it, to be honest. But the non-smart alecky way of saying this is there are about 12 to 13,000 animals in human care around the world at zoos, aquariums, wildlife rehab centers, captive breeders. And they represent a really good cross-section of what biodiversity looks like at this point in time. Because zoos high-graded. They collected and started breeding the animals that are fabulous in terms of what they do and how they look and how they sound. And so that's why we go to these institutions where the animals are already housed. And these are animals that are born and raised in captivity by and large and are used to people. And it's a very simple process, actually.
I have a hard enough time getting my quasi-domesticated tabby cat to hold still for a photo. How hard is it to get some of these animals into these shots?
Well, we work with the zoos a long time in advance. For the larger animals, we work with the zoo to paint an off-exhibit space black or white, and then we shift the animal in. Well before I get there, usually, the animal's used to coming in and having lunch in that space. And so on the day I show up a few weeks later, the animal comes in to have lunch. When he finishes chewing and looks at me once or twice, we get the picture and move on. If it's a smaller animal, we'll often have them, they're trained to go into a transport crate or kennel, and we bring them up to a shooting tent, and we open the door and they walk into this shooting tent, and we photograph them in there. And sometimes the shoots last 10, 15 minutes, and sometimes they last 30 seconds.
How do you feel when you're connecting with these creatures to take these intimate photos?
I feel very honored, and there's a lot of pressure, actually, because I'm often the only one that ever gives them the time of day. Most of the animals I photograph are dead alongside a ruler, maybe by the biologist that described the species, putting it in a museum. But there's not really been anybody since. And I may be the first and only one that photographs them alive and looking normal with their full colors and behaving normally. We do video as well. Because so many times now, especially when I travel abroad, I'm looking at the very last of their kind in a captive setting. The very last of them. So this is the chance that they have.
What's so powerful about these animal portraits?
The animals, they are intelligent and they are malicious and they're conniving and they're joyful and they're tired out and they're way over the top. And the animals they're just like us. And so when we connect with them by looking them in the eye, they really register with people. And so some of them think they've been abducted by the mothership and they just stand in there and look around. They don't know, you know, it's a big white room. And some of them, like chimps at the Sunset Zoo in Manhattan, Kansas, I used a paper background, which was really stupid, and they just shredded it in like 10 seconds. So we didn't get anywhere with them.
You've been a photographer for National Geographic for nearly 30 years.
Yes.
What got you started taking pictures of wildlife?
My mother cared about wildlife, and so did my dad. And my mom got me a Time Life picture book, and in that book was a picture of Martha, the last passenger pigeon, who died at the Cincinnati Zoo in 1914. Those birds numbered in the billions, and people market hunted them to extinction. So they went from billions to that one bird, and they had a picture of the bird alive, taken in 1914, right before she died. And I stared at that picture a lot as I was a kid, like really concentrated on that. Would go back to that book over and over again, just wondering how we could reduce something to extinction. And that is what drives me today. I don't want to see that happen anymore. It's really important to remember zoos are conservation centers now, and they are literally keepers of the ark. Not me, them. They have living specimens, living collections, breeding collections that will continue that species forward because the woods have been cut wherever they're from. And so until we get smart enough to reforest or to replant, these are the animals we have, the ones that are in captive institutions. So they're keeping the ark alive. Literally, they're doing that every day.
Joel Sartori is a photographer for National Geographic. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
The exhibition featuring several of Joel Sartori's pictures opens tomorrow at the Dallas Zoo. It runs through early September. We have some of Sartori's photos at kerinews.org and a couple of special guests from the Dallas Zoo stopped by the KERA newsroom today, a sloth and an owl. Check out KERA's Facebook page to see a video of their visit. Partly cloudy skies later this evening, low around 67. Tomorrow should be partly sunny with a high near 83. It's currently 85 degrees in Dallas, 82 in Fort Worth. It's 6:32. This is KERA News.